And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, ladies and gents. This is your synoptically genial host, John Derbyshire, with a somewhat truncated version of Radio Derb, your one-stop source for all the news that matters. The reason for the truncation is that I'm filing the podcast on Thursday this week, not Friday, as is usually the case. On Friday, I shall be heading down to Tennessee for the American Renaissance Conference, to which I shall be giving a talk on Saturday morning. In previous years, I have filed from Tennessee on the Friday evening, but for reasons it would be tedious to relate, I can't do that this year. What follows will therefore be shorter than usual. It will in fact be a miscellany of brief items, although I won't rule out the possibility that I might get carried away and comment on one or two particular topics at normal length. Let's see. As a long-standing Hungarophile, I was glad to see our president playing host to Prime Minister Viktor Orbán of Hungary on Monday this week. The two guys seem to have gotten along famously, the president referring to Orbán at one point as his twin. My own sentimental Hungarophilia aside, it's good to see the president being chummy with Orbán, because this chumminess might move the Overton window a bit. Orbán is a strong nationalist who's taken a determined stand on keeping Hungary Hungarian. He's fenced his borders to keep out the Middle Eastern and African bogus refugees who have been flooding other European countries, and he has promoted strong pro-natalist policies, encouraging Hungarians to have more children. We can only dream of a US Congress enacting similar policies. Our nation's legislative and judicial elites favour open borders and family size kept down by feminism, low wages and easy abortion. Still, for our president to show friendship and hospitality to a leader trying to head his country in the opposite direction, the right direction, is encouraging, and it might get people thinking about how wrong-headed our current policies are.
Talpra magyar, híja haza, itt az idő, most vagy soha, rabok legyünk, vagy szabadok, ez a kérdés, válasszatok.
New York City's communist mayor, Bill de Blasio, has joined the list of people running for next year's Democratic presidential nomination, to widespread mockery. I think he's number 25 on the list. De Blasio's a joke even in his own city, whose municipal politics is dominated by wealthy liberals and public sector workers with extravagant benefits packages. It's hard to feel sorry for the New Yorkers being milked by these crooks, as very few New Yorkers bother to vote in mayoral elections. De Blasio was elected in 2013 on a 13% turnout. When he ran for re-election in 2017, voter interest was higher. Turnout was all the way up to 18%. In New York City, the crooked interests get what they pay for. New Yorkers at large get what they can't be bothered to vote against. Is de Blasio really so far gone in delusional narcissism he thinks he can be president? I wouldn't say it's impossible. Much more likely, though, he has enough of a grip on reality to know that presidentially, he's a no-hoper. The point of this campaign is to keep his name in the news as a player in the Democratic Party, so that, in the event a Democrat wins the presidency next year, de Blasio will be on the lists for jobs in the new administration. This is America, land of opportunity. Heck, if Hillary Clinton can be Secretary of State, I don't see why Bill de Blasio couldn't be, EEOC Commissioner, or Deputy Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, or some such undemanding sinecure. Yeah, you may laugh, but do you have a job with an impressive title, a handsome salary, a spacious office among all the movers and shakers of Washington, D.C., and a lavish expense account? Do you have a job where you're not expected to accomplish anything beyond spending boxcar loads of federal money? Do you have a job you can quit after a couple of years to slide into a 7-digit lobbying gig and a lush federal pension? Do you have a job like that? Neither do I. De Blasio isn't as dumb as he looks. How could he be? A listener takes issue with my saying last week, in reference to Jared Kushner's plan to change our immigration laws, that, quote from me, Kushner has no track record of being interested in immigration at all, or of knowing any of the key facts about it, end quote. If that's the case, my listener observed, Jared doesn't talk much to his sister, Nicole Mayer. The topic here is the EB-5 visa category, which we have covered at vdare.com many times over the years. To quote from one of my own pieces about the EB-5, quote, "The EB stands for employment-based. The idea of the program is to encourage foreign entrepreneurs to create jobs for Americans by investing in new or troubled businesses here. In return, the entrepreneur, along, of course, with spouse and children, gets to settle in the USA." End quote. The EB-5 visa is an open invitation to fraud. The foreign entrepreneurs who buy into it first and foremost want the right to settle themselves and their families in the USA. Wanting to actually make money on the deal comes a distant second. Quote from a New York Times story about the EB-5, quote, "Although the program was created as a way to finance projects in economically troubled neighborhoods, it has instead turned into a form of cheap financing for luxury real estate developers. Applicants are primarily seeking the visa, so they typically do not seek a significant return on their investment." End quote. 3/4 of EB-5 investors come from China. What would be an example of a luxury real estate developer gaming this visa program to raise money from foreign investors in return for getting them settlement rights? Well, one example would be Kushner Companies, of which Jared Kushner was CEO until his father-in-law ascended to the presidency in January 2017. Just 4 months after that, Jared's sister ran a roadshow in China, Beijing and Shanghai, recruiting wealthy Chinese to invest in New Jersey real estate in return for settlement rights here in America for themselves and their families. That's what the New York Times story is about. It's dated May 7th, 2017. Jared had, as I said, removed himself from any hands-on involvement with Kushner Company's dealings at Trump's inauguration 4 months previously. But his sister was not shy about dropping appropriate hints to potential Chinese investors. She told the Beijing audience that the real estate project she was pitching, quote, means a lot to me and my entire family, end quote. Kushner Companies were sufficiently embarrassed about that, one of their spokespeople actually apologised for it. It's all depressingly Clinton-esque. I had hoped for better from Trump and his family. When the Kushner immigration plan is finally revealed to us in all its details, will abolition of the EB-5 visa program be part of it? I'm not holding my breath. In Britain, the Brexit saga rumbles on. Next month, it will be 3 years since the referendum in which a majority of British voters said they want out of the European Union. The consummation of their wishes seems no closer now than it was back then. One consequence of these 3 years' indecision may be the destruction of Britain's Conservative Party. This would be pretty astonishing. The Tories have been around under one name or another since the 17th century. They have produced some of the great names in British politics: Peel and Disraeli, Lord Salisbury, Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher. The party's demise is being widely predicted over there, though. James Dellingpole made the case at Breitbart on Wednesday. Quote from James, who is himself a Tory. Will I be upset to see the party die? Not really. I've never been a party loyalist. I'm an ideologue. I only ever supported the Conservatives because I thought they were the likeliest delivery mechanism for the things I believe in. But it has been years since the Conservative Party was in any way conservative. End quote. The party's death is not inconceivable. They performed terribly in the local council elections on May 2nd, losing more than 1,300 seats nationwide. An even worse rout is expected in the elections to the European Parliament next Thursday. The Tories are polling at 12%. If that's how the actual vote breaks, it will be the Tories' worst result in a nationwide election ever. Another quote from James Dellingpole, quote, the Conservatives are now so utterly discredited that only the most radical action can now possibly deliver them from oblivion. It has come to this. Either the Conservatives deliver a Brexit so hard that it hurts, or they die. End quote. The broader lesson here is that a comfortable, complacent, centre-right national political party whose heart lies with globalism and open immigration can be destroyed by the populist nationalism of its base. Does this lesson have relevance outside Britain? Discuss among yourselves. I'm starting to develop some seriously negative feelings towards Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand. The massacres at those Christchurch mosques back in March were terrible, no doubt. But Ms. Ardern is plainly using them as a pretext for crushing any kind of dissident right opinionating, not just in her own country, but worldwide. Mail Online, May 14th, quote, Jacinda Ardern and Emmanuel Macron will urge world leaders to sign up to a Christchurch call aimed at banning violent extremist content online at the G7 summit in Paris tomorrow. End quote. Macron is, of course, the president of France, a country in northwest Europe. He is currently engaged in trying to suppress his own nation's Yellow Jackets movement, a populist uprising against progressive elites like Ms. Ardern and Mr. Macron. Banning violent extremist content online. Not hard to guess what counts as extremist to those two. I can pretty much hear the thought police banging on my door already. I got a little blast from the past reading Razib Khan's May 13th piece at National Review. Just some background on Razib. I have known him for more than 20 years, since we were both on Steve Saylor's original human biodiversity discussion group. Razib is a geneticist, most particularly a population geneticist, with a wonderfully comprehensive knowledge of how the various peoples of the world differ from each other and how they got to be where they are. Razib runs the Gene Expression blog at gnxp.com. His May 11th post there on the Uyghurs is pretty representative of his interests: history, religion, and population genetics. Just a word of warning, if you feel you want to comment at that blog, let me tell you that Razib is a serious rival to Greg Cochran for the world championship of Not Suffering Fools Gladly. If you want to challenge him, just make quite sure you know what you're talking about. Well, on Tuesday, Razib published this piece at National Review. Title: Conservatives Shouldn't Fear Evolutionary Theory. The piece is a polite and non-vituperative, but very eloquent defence of the scientific approach in general, and of modern evolutionary biology in particular. Sample quote: Nature is not wish fulfilment. Reality is not constructed by social ideologies. End quote. As I started by saying, this piece struck me as a blast from the past, and it stirred a peculiar kind of nostalgia in me. Let me try to explain that. When I first got involved in writing for conservative outlets in the USA 20-some years ago, creationism, which had been rebranded in the 1990s as intelligent design, creationism was the default position among my colleagues. Bill Buckley, for example, was a creationist. Pat Buchanan, I think, still is one. Ann Coulter, likewise, last time I checked. I have been a science geek from childhood, and I spoke up for science and against creationism in those conservative outlets I was writing for, to the displeasure of some of my colleagues. National Review, to their credit, let me speak my mind freely, to the displeasure of some of their readers. One anti-creationism piece that I published in their pages in February 2005 got the attention of the Discovery Institute, which is a creationist think tank in Seattle. They sent a whole squad of people over to New York to try to get the magazine back on the creationist rails, including some of their big guns, Bruce Chapman, George Gilder, Michael Behe. We, that is me and a couple of National Review editors, we met with them in the library. The exchanges were cordial, but of course, nobody's mind was changed. Creationism is still around, but it's faded as an issue among legacy conservatives, what we at VDare.com call conservatism inc. And it's not an issue at all on the dissident right, as far as I'm aware. The dissident right is science-friendly. Why wouldn't it be? Everything that science turns up reinforces our view of human nature. What caused creationism to lose market share? Well, it suffered two setbacks, one of them sudden and one gradual. The sudden setback was the Kitzmiller decision of later that year, the year 2005. A Pennsylvania school board had mandated the teaching of creationism. Some parents sued, and they won their case. The creationists did not come well out of Kitzmiller. The courtroom exchanges shone an unflattering light on their dishonesty and double talk. That was the sudden setback. The gradual setback was the rapid advances in genetics that were getting airborne about the same time, as described by Razib in this week's piece. In the last 15 years, we have gotten a much better grip on the actual chemical and biological processes underlying evolutionary change. Science has greatly improved our understanding. None of the new things we have learned supports creationism. None of them has overthrown orthodox biology, as creationists of the 1990s were promising was about to happen any day. Meanwhile, as real science has advanced, creationism has stood still, adding nothing to the stock of human knowledge. The science versus creationism matchup has turned out to be no contest. So, Razib's Tuesday article looked a bit quaint. Having been on the side of science all along, believing that truth is better than falsehood, I'm glad that creationism has declined. At the same time, though, I can't help feeling some nostalgia for it. Creationism was ignorant and unscientific, but it was harmless. It was, in fact, a remnant of the old, weird America, for which people of my generation feel a romantic affection. Creationism was very American. I suppose we had creationists in England 50 years ago, but they made no noise. Nobody paid them any attention. It was one of those quirky American things, like high school proms, or affixing junior to your name, or eating peanut butter with jam. If, as is probably the case, if ignorant and unscientific attitudes are bound to be widespread in any society, better they should be of the harmless kind, like creationism, than that they should be of the persecuting, anti-human, totalitarian kind, like the cultural Marxist ideology now dominant in the West. Creationism was nutty and wrong, but in a civilized way, a very American way. Now we have a new style of superstitious ignorance, a style that is not civilized at all, nor especially American, a style that is barbarous, violent, cosmopolitan, and crazed with power. I was never going to be a creationist, but now that creationism is fading, I miss it. My very strong preference is that youngsters in our schools and colleges be taught true facts about nature and about human nature. If that's too much to ask and we're going to teach the kids hogwash, I'd rather it was the harmless, nutty, American hogwash of creationism than the evil, poisonous, nation-breaking hogwash of cultural Marxism. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening, and thanks in advance to American Renaissance for what looks as though it's going to be a splendid, instructive and invigorating conference down there in Tennessee. This week we lost movie actress and singer Doris Day. Among her many other accomplishments, Miss Day was the first woman I was ever in love with. That was back in the early 1950s, when, at the age of 8, I was taken to the local picture palace to see her movie, Calamity Jane. I thought I had never seen a girl so pretty, and I yearned for her, in, of course, the innocent 8-year-old style. Well, well, golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers, come to dust. Doris has gone at the fine, hearty age of 97. I got over her at last, and I found true love with another. But there is still a faint glow for me around her name and image. Here she was back in 1953, when Cupid's dart first pierced my infant heart. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Once I had a secret love that lived within the heart of me. All too soon my secret love became impatient to to be free. So I told a friendly star the way that dreamers often do. Just a wonderful you. And why I'm so in love with you.